This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO Community Radio and Veterans for Peace Chapter 72 are proud to co-sponsor a special presentation on Thursday, August 1st at 6:30 p.m. An insider's account of Guantanamo will examine the illegality, immorality, and inhumanity of the U.S. Naval Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, with Stephen T. Wax, Chief Federal Public Defender for the District of Oregon, Laura Sandown, a U.S. Navy veteran who served at Guantanamo, and S. Brian Wilson, a longtime peace activist, among others. An insider's account of Guantanamo will take place at the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue in downtown Portland. Thursday, August 1st, doors open at 6:30 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Pierre Fogring. This is KBOO Portland. And my guest is Chris Nelder, who is he's written a couple books on energy and investing, and he's the energy columnist for the Smart Planet newsletter. So, Chris Nelder, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's get right into it. We've got a couple of your articles here, and, you know, there's been so much talk about oil, abundance of oil in America. You know, it's about Saudi America. We're going to be energy independent. It just, I don't know. It doesn't add up to me. What about you?
No, it doesn't really add up. There's been an awful lot of sort of irrational exuberance about the potential for tight oil and fracking more generally in the U.S. But if you just get into the data a little bit, look at what production has actually done. It's been a wonderful boon. It's been a terrific turnaround for American tight oil and gas, but it's not going to make us a net exporter. We're not going to exceed Saudi Arabia. We're never going to be a net oil exporter. And we don't have 100 years worth of gas.
Well, you know, they talk about these huge reserves. You know, there's billions of gallons under the ground. And what's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, there's really no doubt that there's a lot of oil or things that can be made into synthetic oil trapped underground. But the question is, how quickly can you produce it, and what's the cost of producing it? And that's what really matters. Most of the stuff that you hear about the potential for unconventional oil and gas in the United States just really talks about the size of the reserves. They don't talk about what it actually costs to produce it, whether or not that price is something that consumers can tolerate, or how quickly it can be produced. And, you know, with respect to the question of peak oil, that's all that really matters is the rate of production. How quickly can you produce it? You know, the world is at about 91 million barrels a day of all liquids production, about 75 million barrels a day of crude oil. And the real question now is, you know, how much longer can we hold on to those levels before the depletion from mature fields that have been pumping for 30, 40 years finally overwhelms new additions from things like fracking?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to see that point before 2020.
Well, you know, somebody compared it to it's like having $1 million in your bank account, but you're only allowed to take out $50 a month.
Yeah, exactly right. You're not worried about running out of money. You're worried about paying your bills.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, like, the bank charges you an extra $10 just to take out the money, too.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Well, so this is very interesting. I think a lot of people are not aware that that every year these oil wells deplete. I mean, I heard about 5% a year globally?
Yeah, there's been a number of different studies done over the last several years. Different agencies have, you know, looked at it in different ways and come up with different numbers. The last time the IEA, the International Energy Agency in Paris, did a real study on that a few years ago, they came up with a global average of about 5.5% per year. But of course, you know, it's not all equal. Deep water wells, fracking, you know, the tight oil wells, deplete very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
They'll lose, you know, 40% or more in the first year. And the depletion rates vary, you know, from one field to another. So in aggregate, you know, in the world, you're probably looking at an average of about 5.5% per year declines. And so that's, you know, that's sort of this undertow that we're always swimming against when we try to bring on new production from things like fracking.
Yeah, I understand that up in Williston, North Dakota, I mean, the place is just dotted with oil wells because they, you know, they drill one and in a few years there's very little left, so they have to keep drilling new wells all the time.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, a recent analysis that I've seen suggests that they need to drill about 120 wells a month just to keep production flat in the Bakken.
Well, why don't, you know, it sort of amazes me. I mean, it's like a conspiracy of silence or something. I mean, like they, you know, you keep hearing these stories about all these oil reserves and nobody really brings up the fact of what it costs to get the oil out. And it's just, you know, what is the... Another thing I read was that, you know, in 1859, the first oil well in Pennsylvania, they struck oil at 69 feet.
You know?
And then you had all these, you know, after that, you had all these gushers in Oklahoma and Texas. Well, you know, now they're drilling, what, 3,000 feet under the ocean and horizontal drilling and all the fracking. That's bound to cost money to do that. And so I understand that the oil wells in North Dakota, it doesn't make a profit unless the oil is about $100 a barrel.
Well, that may or may not be the case. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult, actually, to get firm numbers on what the level of profitability is for tight oil producers in the Bakken. You know, you'll get different numbers from different producers who are operating in those fields, and they will usually just quote you the numbers that are best case for the sweet spots in those fields, where they might be able to make money at, you know, $70 or $80 a barrel for certain wells. And then for other wells, they might need $100 a barrel to make money on those.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you average it all together, my guess is they probably need $85, $90 a barrel on a sustained basis to keep production up in the Bakken. And right now they've got it. You know, we're well above that now with U.S. oil prices. So, you know, I think the production there is going to continue. I don't think it's going to grow a great deal more. It's hard to say. You know, we've got certain forecasters like Wood Mackenzie or even EIA think that we're going to get another 3 million barrels a day out of tight oil in the U.S. Through 2020. And, you know, depending on the price, depending on how they do as they move off some of the sweet spots in these fields in the coming years and get into some of the more marginal areas of those fields, that may or may not be true. You know, we're just going to kind of have to wait and see. But, you know, I'd just point out that when you've got a background decline rate globally of 5.5% per year, you need to add around 3 to 3.8 million barrels a day of production every year just to keep output flat. I mean, that's how much you're losing from depletion. So all of the growth that is expected by the optimists from U.S. tight oil from fracking will be consumed by 1 year of global oil depletion.
Mm. Well, tell us about, you know, there's a difference now between crude oil and, non-crude liquids. So what is the difference? People don't seem to be aware of that.
Yeah. You know, we play a lot of games with definitions and numbers in the press, or some people do anyway. Actual crude production, as I said, is now about 75 million barrels a day worldwide. It just moved up to 75 after being at like 74 million barrels a day since 2004. Beyond that, you've got all kinds of other liquids that bring the liquid fuels that bring the total global number up to about 91 million barrels a day. And so the difference between 75 and 91 is natural gas liquids, it's biofuels like ethanol. There's a kind of a sketchy category called refinery gains, which means that the volume of oil when it's turned into things like gasoline and diesel actually expands, but it doesn't actually mean that there's any additional energy there. It's just a greater volume. And there's, you know, a smattering of other little kinds of liquids that kind of go in there. I mean, in theory, we can turn natural gas and coal into liquid fuels. That's not being done at any scale, because it just doesn't make economic sense, but it could be done. So, you know, there's actually, though, a big difference in terms of the value of crude oil versus the value of some of these other liquids. Crude oil contains 5.8 million BTUs per barrel, and it can be made into a million different things, not just gasoline and diesel, but all kinds of plastics and petrochemicals and, you know, pharmaceuticals and all kinds of stuff. You can't really say the same for some of these unconventional liquids. Biofuels like corn ethanol contain about two-thirds the energy, so they don't have the same energy content, and you can't make them into all the same products that you can make crude oil into. Natural gas liquids, which is a big part of this, you know, new bump in production that we've got from fracking in the U.S., some of that can be made, you know, a small part of it can be made into liquid fuels, can be mixed into gasoline, but most of it can't. Most of it is useful for making things like, you know, propane for your barbecue or being turned into different kinds of plastics, that kind of thing. Hmm. So there is a big difference between crude oil and, you know, the all liquids number that you hear.
So we're kind of fooling ourselves when you lump them all together.
Yeah, we are. But, you know, a lot of people in the press just like to report, you know, the big flashy headline number. Mm-hmm. They'll report the big number without actually explaining what it means.
Wow.
So, you know, on a crude basis, you know, U.S. production has come up just a little bit from where it bottomed out. You know, we're back up to roughly 1995 levels now. But if you look at the all liquids number, it looks like we've gone all the way back to 1985 levels. So there is a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is Fight the Empire. My guest is Chris Nelder, who is the energy columnist for Smart Planet Newsletter. Well, it just seems to me that people are bound to be disappointed maybe within a few years. I mean, do the people who are kind of pushing this line, are they aware of it? Are they? I don't understand their... Don't they expect that the truth will kind of be apparent after a while?
Well, I suppose they might, but you know, when your objective is to write an article that will get a lot of clicks, you're going to write an article that talks about how great fracking is and how it's going to, you know, fix the U.S. Budget deficit, and it's going to restore our weight in the world as a geopolitical player in oil, and it plays into the whole theme of American exceptionalism, and you know, we love that stuff. We click on those articles, but then, you know, if it turns out not to be true 4 or 5 years from now, well, probably no one will remember that article was written. Probably no one will go back and look at it or try to hold the writer or the publisher accountable. So you know, it's just kind of a sad fact about our journalism today that we don't do a lot of fact-checking on that stuff, and we don't really try to create a record that we can stand on for a long time. We just churn it out, you know, today's news is tomorrow's fish wrap.
Well, I was just thinking, not just the media, but the, you know, the government and the oil industry. What are they expecting, say, down the road? Or are they not, I don't know, are they just totally in the dark or what?
Well, I think the industry has promoted a story of abundance, and they've done it very effectively over the last couple years. You know, the fact that production has risen so sharply and so substantially, you know, about 2 million barrels a day of new production in just a couple years. I mean, that's a big turnaround, and it is a big story. And it is something to crow about, and so they've promoted the story, and the press has been eager to report it. I think at a government level, you know, unfortunately, I don't think we do a lot of really careful, deliberate, and independent analysis of you know, what these new kind of resources are really worth and where it's really taking us. I think in a lot of ways, you know, the industry has the best information about what's happening out there. And so that stuff just winds up sort of getting filtered and compiled and presented to the watchdogs and government, you know, who unfortunately really don't have the time or the expertise or maybe the staff to go out and seek alternative points of view, or to really attempt to do, you know, a discriminate, independent analysis of the different views on the future of oil. So, in a lot of ways, the government view is the industry view.
Well, now, when you talk about this increase in production, is that total production, or is that net production? Because it takes energy to get the energy.
Yeah, well, we're just talking about volumes here. We're not talking about the energy content. So, yeah, that's absolute.
So if they say we're getting an extra 2 million barrels a day or whatever, that when you consider what you put in to get those 2 million barrels, it's less than that.
Yeah, on an energy basis, substantially less. If you just look at the headline numbers, you know, you'll see that U.S. production of oil, in quotes, meaning all liquids, is about 11,000 barrels a day. If you just look at, you know, then that really kind of overstates the actual crude production in the U.S. by about a third.
Well, you know, a couple of years ago, you wrote an article about the real great contraction. Can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, this is kind of a big macro view. So looking out over like a 100-year time span, you know, you look at the general arc of global oil production, where that might be going, and then you look at the total arc of natural gas and coal, and you look at the trajectory of renewables, which are growing very, very rapidly, but starting at a very low level. And you start to look at, okay, over the next 100 years, how much energy is the world really going to have at its disposal? And how big of a population can you support with that energy? And, you know, my study of the numbers tells me that I don't think we're ever going to get to 9 billion people on this planet, which is what pretty much all of the global forecasting agencies, the, you know, the World Bank or what have you, believe that we're going to 9 billion people on this planet, because that's what the population curve tells you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you factor that against the available energy, you know, you don't support people on this planet without energy. You don't really do anything without energy. You don't harvest food. You don't do anything. You don't make stuff. You don't go anywhere. So when you really take all that into account, and then you start to factor in some other more complicated subjects like the return on energy investment, you know, how much energy does it take to produce energy? And that's a number that's been going up and up, or if you like, a ratio that's been falling. It starts to paint a very different picture of the future. And, you know, my surmise after looking at all this data and trying to take all these complicated things into account, including price, including, you know, kind of this monetary and fiscal situation that we've been in for the last decade or so, and particularly since the financial crisis of 2008, you know, my surmise is that we're going to be entering a period of economic contraction,
mm-hmm.
Where you just can't keep maintaining an economic growth rate long into the future. And unfortunately, our economies and in fact the issuance of debt and the valuation of our currency is predicated on that growth rate continuing. So I think we're in for a bit of a shock, but I'm not the kind of person who's, you know, sort of preaching apocalypse. I think it's instead of like a fast collapse scenario, which a lot of people have promoted, I view it as more of a long, slow contraction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we're basically over time, over the next century, we're going to be traveling less, we're going to be eating less, we're not going to be driving around individually in cars. We're going to be using, you know, hopefully electrified rail or some sort of mass transportation like that that can run on renewable energy ultimately. We're going to be, instead of getting food from the other side of the world, we're going to be eating what's produced locally. Instead of getting, you know, instead of shipping iron ore from Brazil over to China to be turned into steel, over to the U.S. to be manufactured into stuff, we're going to be trying to bring all these supply chains into more of a local focus. So I think the contraction that we're going to experience over the next century, you know, it certainly will have a few sharp drops, particularly when we have occasional oil price spikes or price spikes for other forms of primary energy over that period of time. But I think generally it's going to be characterized as kind of the reverse of globalization and a long, slow economic contraction to the point where we're all just basically living on a lot less energy mm-hmm. per person.
What happens? What happens to debts? Do debts get paid? If they don't get paid, what happens to the financial system?
Well, that's another really important question that ties into all this. You know, I used to sort of laugh at the notion of like some sort of a giant global debt jubilee, but now I see some very serious people taking that idea seriously. I don't really know how that's going to work. You know, I don't have a call on that. But I do think that for the average person, the smart thing to do is to eliminate their debt as much as possible and be as self-sufficient as possible to sort of, you know, live within their immediate means, to try to grow as much of their own food as they can, to try to get around on a bicycle, to try to avoid debt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's what really matters for the average person.
Well, you can do that on a community level, too. I mean, here in Portland,
absolutely.
Here in Portland, about 5 years ago, they had a peak oil task force. They made a lot of recommendations. So the city, at least officially, is trying to deal with this, although they keep pushing things that seem to go the other way. But If the financial system is falling apart, and if the, say, the stock market, well, right now the stock market is doing pretty well, but suppose I won the lottery and I had $1 million or something, what would I do with it? You know, you open up a bank account, you get a less than 1% interest. What do the rich people do with their money? Where do they invest it? What's a safe haven, as they say?
I'm a big fan of hard assets.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of physical things. If you suddenly had $1 million dropped on you and you feel up to the task, I would say start producing some food. You know, start some sort of a little farm, and invest that money in animals and seeds and farming equipment, tractor, that kind of thing.
But if the oil is expensive, you're not going to be running your tractors very much either.
Well, you know, the reason Rudolf Diesel invented his engine was to give farmers a way to get out from under the thumb of the oil companies.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He invented it to run on peanut oil or any other oilseed crop. It originally ran on peanut oil.
Mm-hmm.
So his concept was, let farmers grow the fuel that they need to run their tractor.
Mm-hmm.
You can certainly do that today. Of course, now there's another option. I mean, look at John Howe, what he's done, outfitting an old tractor to run on solar. It's a DIY setup, but it works.
Really?
Yeah. He's got a little solar array and some batteries, and he just took an old a really old tractor, like a one from the 30s I think it was, and just outfitted it with a little solar system, and he's able to do you're not going to be running a giant combine that way, you're not going to be working over hundreds of acres that way, but for a small farmer it would work.
Well, that's very cheery news. It really is.
Yeah, no, there's ways to do it, but in general, I'm really bullish on hard assets. You know, I think if you've got cash and you don't need liquidity, forget about bonds, forget about traditional fixed income, vehicles. I mean, that stuff isn't going to give you any interest rate, and it's not going to give you any protection against the Great Contraction. If you want to give yourself a little buffer against the changes that are coming, then the solution is to invest that stuff in hard assets to make yourself as self-sufficient as possible. And, there's a lot of dimensions to that. You know, if you don't feel up to being a small farmer, well, maybe you want to make some beer or some wine, or maybe you want to find a way to make some other real products that people can actually need and use on a daily basis. Essentially, I think we're in the future. We're heading into a reality that would have been very familiar to our great grandparents.
Well, if you buy farmland, then you have to either farm it yourself, or else you have to have farm workers do it for you. And this goes on a national level. These countries are gobbling up land in Africa like crazy. Well, I hear my theme music here, so I think we're going to have to end this on this note.
Then.
It's been very good talking to you. Do you have a website where people can read your articles?
I post all of my work to my website, getreallist.com.
GetRealList.com. Okay, we've been talking with Chris Nelder, who is the energy columnist for the Smart Planet newsletter, which is another thing you can look up. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
And thank you for listening to KBOO. We are KBOO Portland. Just about a minute now before 10 o'clock. Coming up in 1 hour, Between the Covers, today author George Packer discusses his latest book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. And then at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, Dr. Earl Bracey talks about his book, Too Young to Die, Inner City Adolescent Homicides and the Making of a Psychologist. Up next, it is Flashpoints.
Slip a bookmark into your paperback and listen to KBOO for interviews with your favorite fiction and nonfiction writers. Between the Covers airs Thursdays from 11 to 11:30 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Flashpoints, 100,000 plus people sign a petition in support of military whistleblower Bradley Manning being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Also, the Dreamers and their supporters attacked at the U.S.-Mexico border on Sunday. We'll hear what happened and talk about the battle for humane immigration reform. These Dreamers are courageous, and will feature sounds from Precious Knowledge, a film that documents the banning of books and the entire Mexican-American studies program in Tucson. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavila Molina. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And Norman Solomon writes, Tuesday's verdict from a military judge does not diminish the huge moral stature of whistleblower Bradley Manning. Thanks to Manning, vast troves of information have become public knowledge, making possible more informed debate about war and peace. For